this started, although I know we're a bit low on numbers of people who booked tickets or said they were coming, but equally I know that there are a lot of people stuck somewhere on the Jubilee line, so may find that people come in slowly. But anyway, welcome to the Freud Museum, particularly those of you who haven't been here before. I'm Carol Siegel, I'm the director of the Freud Museum, so it's a pleasure to welcome everyone. And this is one of the events in association with the exhibition that we've got on at the moment, Freud and Eros, Love, Lust and Longing. And you may have already had a chance to have a look around the museum, and you'll see the bulk of the exhibition is next door, and then there's some contemporary artworks downstairs. So I think as well this evening there'll be some poetry readings, but also a break in the middle, so a chance to kind of have a look around. And obviously if you haven't seen Freud's study before, then that's the kind of heart of the house, and really take the opportunity to go down and have a look at his psychoanalytic couch and desk in the library and so on, because that really is what gives the house its atmosphere. As I said, that the house is open until the end of the event, so please, as well, do take the opportunity to go to the shop, which some of you have already been to, perhaps, to get your tickets, because there'll be the opportunity both to buy the book, Mildly Erotic Poetry, but also some unusual Christmas presents, perhaps. So do take the chance to go and have a look at the shop. But it's a pleasure. I don't know what the collective term is for a clutch of poets or a gathering of poets. Or is there a collective term? If not, a stanza of poets. Okay. But anyway, it's a pleasure to welcome all of you from the Emma Press to tonight's reading of Mildly Erotic Verse. So without further ado, thank you, and over to Emma.
Thanks, Carol. Yes, I'm Emma Wright, so I run the Emma Press, and I'm very happy to be here with my Mildly Erotic Poets as part of the Freud and Eros events. So the way that the evening is going to work, I'm going to introduce all the poets, and I'll tell you how that each of them will read some of their own Mildly Erotic poems, and then we'll have a short break so you can kind of, with their erotic words ringing in your heads, you can explore the exhibition. And then we'll return, and they'll read some of the poems by other people, which they find erotic. So it's quite a comprehensive view of poetry and eroticism. So just to start off by introducing these people in front of you. First of all, we have Kirsty Irving, who's an amazing poet who's been published by Salt and by Hathens Dance, and she co-edits for the amazing small publishing company, Sidekick Books. And then there's Stephen Sexton, who's from Belfast. He's studying for a PhD at the Seamus Heaney Centre for Poetry. And the Emma Press has recently published his first pamphlet, Oils. And then there's Ruth Wiggins from Walthamstow. She's a member of the Forest Poets, and we just published her pamphlet, Myrtle. And she studied Latin at university, so she has quite a lot of classical influences to her work. And I'm Emma Wright. And I set up the Emma Press 2 years ago, and the Mildly Erotic anthology was actually the first anthology that I'd created. So I published one pamphlet of love poems, and then this was the first anthology, which came about because I'd been working as a large publisher in London around the time that 50 Shades of Grey got really big. So I was there working on the e-books when 50 Shades of Grey started becoming a phenomenon. And obviously working in the ebook departments, it meant that suddenly my publisher was kind of digging around this backlist for all the erotic titles they could muster up, as well as producing their own kind of 50 Shades of Grey spin-off, which was called 80 Days Yellow.
Really?
It's a bestseller. And the title makes no sense since I've read it. Like I tell you, 80 Days is irrelevant and there's nothing to do with yellow in it. But anyway, it made for a nice, I guess, it moved on, there were 80 days yet, red and 80 days blue as well. And so partly through working at this publisher and both reading the erotic books that came through my production line and also reading all the coverage of the phenomenon. So the combination of those two things made me come up with the idea for the book because I was really intrigued, partly by what I read, and, well, I didn't read 50 Shades of Grey because I was cheap and didn't buy it, but I did read 50 Shades of Yellow because it was free. And I was just really fascinated by this kind of committee view of eroticism, which has obviously been brainstormed by a team just to think of what, how to kind of copy the success. And it was really fascinating seeing what some people, what the editors and the writers had thought, this is what people want. And it really just struck me that this wasn't very erotic at all. That it was very, well, it was very kind of detailed and assiduous, lots of little details about the mechanics and the actions. And some, it was very surprising that they managed to completely bypass the thrill of eroticism. So that, and also just the coverage of, not the Fifty Shades of Grey, there seems to be a kind of sniggering sense about it, which struck me as odd because sex and racism are actually really, well, they're important and they're grown up, and the way that it was being covered seems to be suggesting that they were silly. It was a kind of silly thing that we were kind of, people reading books for, their erotic content, was being kind of embarrassed by it, which is certainly, well, strange, so, unsurprising, kind of revelation, really. So I wanted to create a book which actually pinpointed what I thought was erotic. So I put out a call for submissions and had over 170 people send in their poems, and of those, I ended up picking 23, and I ended up forming many views about what is erotic. And what I personally find erotic, which I'll tell you about later on after the break. But first of all, we need to hear from the poets. He'll be reading their own poems to start off with, so both from the book and from their oeuvre. So first of all, we're going to hear from Ruth, then Stephen, then Kirsten. So, Ruth McGinnis. Oh, and also some new pictures at the top. So these are illustrations from the book in this first half.
Okay, I'm going to stand up because I've got a very weak voice at the moment and I might carry a little better. Given that we're in such close proximity to probably the most famous couch on the planet, I thought I'd start with this poem, Borrowed Time. This morning, we mostly lay on the couch, impersonating cats, talking gibberish. This afternoon, you fucked me. Right out of my pyjamas and into yours. This evening, we made a day of it. Me in your vest, you in nothing but the heat. We discussed our old fan as it sighed the humidity. Considered the crooked blinds, how they redrafted light into sheet music on the ceiling. Then tonight, you slipped from my arms into a sleep I could not share. Diving without warning, you pulled the oxygen tanks in after you, leaving me trying without hope to pick you out in the deep. I tend to think of that one as my sex and death poem. And someone once said to me that they felt that the use of the word fuck in an obvious love poem was a little too much. And it seems to me that fuck's a really important word in the debate around eroticism. Because it's got that double meaning, that I've got the sexual sense of fucking, but also the obliteration. And I think that ties in with the whole idea of the orgasm as the little death, and pretty more. And I think it's key. And this next poem also explores that double play meaning. So this poem, I imagine what the goddess of love, Venus, might get up to in her spare time. And I sort of cast her as a fairly disgruntled goddess of the old world. It's called Venus at the Potter's Wheel. Screw your Judeo-Christian god. His reputedly deft fingers. Opposable thumbs. I could just as easily throw pots with my thighs. Shape your keen red clay into an urgent vase. Finish you off with a flourish of myrtle. Oh, then you know the meaning of fucked. So there was myrtle in that poem, and myrtle crops up a lot in my work, probably because it's sacred to Venus and symbolic of love. And this next poem is actually called Myrtus, which was the Roman word for myrtle. So this is called Myrtus, and it's my version of an ode by the Roman poet Horace. And the original, which I've taken some homoerotic license with, was addressed to Horace's wine-bearer and was an ode to simplicity. Myrtus. Gorgeous boy, there is no need to overdress. I can't urge you enough. Ditch the artifice. There's no need to bring me pricey black roses, thorny, unscented. And you can lose that spider-spun suit as well. Come to me naked, a simple myrtle sprig right between your teeth. Be mine, right here beneath this cheerful old vine. So, sticking with the... So mentally undressing people, there's a bit of that in this one too. Reynard. Big old dog fox, heavy with health, with cop, the balls on you, curled up there, brassy in the sun. I'd like to take hold of your snout, feel the squeak of your teeth against my thumb. Borrow your coat of wire, big old dog fox. How long do you suppose before I turn? Take to dusting on compost, hoodwinking crows. Stinky, hungry for what it is that makes you blush. Your cunning about my shoulders, quick words rising in my throat. How long before I take a foot to the itch behind my ribs? Forget this knife, this aubergine dish. And this next one is the one that was in the anthology. And I do get quite inspired by the natural world when it comes to erotica. And the reason I think this one fits particularly well with the theme of Eros is that it kind of captures that that yearning that I think is inherent in the whole erotic thing. Birch. Prostrate birch. What's with all the reaching? So keen for something that you can't get straight. You lean. Invite me to saddle up. Strong-backed, you speak to me in mushroom and lichen. Go on, green my tongue. And then my last poem. This one feels appropriate for here. It's just surrounded by all these different gods of the old world. It's basically a hymn to being in the moment and to tenderness. And it was inspired by a sculpture of the god Pan that was found in the ruins of Herculaneum. And the sculpture was of Pan getting it on with a goat. Now, Pan was an ancient shepherd god who had a bit of a thing for nymphs. And it might help to know that Syrinx was a nymph who was turned into a clump of reeds from which Pan made the first set of panpipes. And also might help to know that Athyrsus, it was an ancient fertility symbol that was constructed out of a wand of giant fennel topped with a pine cone. And if you, in the other room, there's a water and wine jar, and there's a picture of one on the jar. While making love to a nanny goat. No need to rush or mount a rear guard action. You've already won her over. Goat herd, you've got her eating out of your palm. bleating at your jocund blaze, your charming ways salutes its foes. So take this last paramour face to face. Ease her into your crib of reed. Bring her dainty hooves up to your chest. Say what the hay if she should choose to nibble at your coronet of pine, so long as you bed your fierceness good and deep inside. Her pleat is as soft as the mountain hareskins in which you were wrapped at birth. Your back, exquisite, it falls with grace into the fleece that curls about your arse and thighs. Remember to take her gently by the beard. Steady her as she goes. No need to heed your hound's giving tongue to some trouble brewing in the hills. For now, the wild mountain echoes with well-hung chimes. You yourself are heavy with bells.
And I'm going to sit too, if you don't mind. I'm going to start by reading the poem that Emma very kindly included in this lovely book, and as such started the lovely relationship, which is that you're reading this, or making this book for me, which is wonderful too. But I'll get to that in a minute. I don't write erotic poems, I don't know how to write erotic poems, but this, maybe by accident or by something else, seemed to be erotic. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that is common in anything that I've written that could be considered erotic is a sort of crucial distance between two people that varies. It gets closer, it gets further away, but always crucially that there's a distance that is trying to be met, hopefully from both sides. And I think most of these poems have that sort of distance in them. This is called Second Circle. And it has a line in it from The Inferno, which is, I think, from the section on the second circle, which is, we were alone and we suspected nothing. You've been going through each book and CD. I found the long black threads of your hair in Crash, which you aren't ashamed to read aloud. So, with the wind as it is, yes, there is a case for staying the night. Branches twist and slap at the picture window where I'll draw the blind, submitting evidence. The streetlights have remade the pressing oak trees into silhouettes. All this in the wind makes a house of my bed. The wind insists. The wind is your breath shallowing on the back of my head. I wake in the night with you behind me and that the wind slight at the windowsill. One twig scratching an inch of glass reminds me you are not asleep. Your hands are far from still. One of the things that was behind this poem was, I'm not sure whose theory it was. My knowledge of Freud is not great. It's not even good. It's an idea that someone had put. People in poetry classes like to think that the world revolves around poetry. And I suppose that would be nice too. But it was an idea that one doesn't speak, one doesn't comment on something, one doesn't make a sound at all, really, unless it's as an expression of need, or an expression of want of some sort. I suppose it's a theory of language anyway. But that's in the back of this poem, which is called Slip. There's a sound that's lust, or boredom, or both, which is a fingertip sounding a note plaintively on the edge of a wine glass. There's also the bright ascent of two glasses clinking, protesting one to the other that I mean you no harm, that I mean you no harm. There's no sound I know for contentment. One thing that I did today, which I didn't mean to do, was forget to bring some poems, and so I've written them out the old-fashioned way, so you'll forgive me for that. I'd like to read two others. One of them is a little bit longer here. And I think there's two things that I was thinking of in that. One, worryingly, was Philip Larkin, possibly the most erotic poet. maybe not. But it was very much in the background of this. His poem Wits and Weddings follows him speaking on a train as he views marriages. I suppose this is quite true as a poem can be. But it's with walking with someone to a train, so it's a version set just before that. And again, it's that idea of a crucial distance, or a distance that is like different. The other thing that's in the back of it is a line by the American poet, Mark Doty, which is a really lovely line, which is, what is description but encoded desire? And I think that there's something of that, of an attempt at total description, as though that might bring this gap closer together, or that might resolve something. So this is a sort of a version of Philip Larkin's poem. Unique distance. On Sunday we were quick getting away. The morning cool and firm as the nacre catches on your coat, settled into May with a whisper. Unstilling the lacquered air with our breaths, we sipped towards your train, passing no one. We walked without speaking, past eyelids of windows, no dogs to bark, no siskins pitching their post-dawn refrain, no sound to shatter the tacit nothing of our steps at the locked gates to the park. It was there, with the sun soft on my back, I spied a weathercock chiming golden in the light, directing his northern beak behind us, back up the hill to that then of the night, from when the wind had trailed off. I thought of something to say, then didn't. Ahead, a filament of moon, slight as a thread of saffron, almost dissolved in the sky. Fresh in the air was the scent of your perfume, lavender, lemon's weight, peach's sweetness. Our long shadows blossomed from our shoes, reluctant to even touch, where before petals of ribs pressed and stems of spines met. Perhaps you cared just as much for yellow vans with a miracle's worth of rolls and baps, or the green cupolas at the city hall where there's row upon rows of colour sprinkled in the warm earth. Portland stone and copper aureolas flotsamed away as we neared the station. I wished you well back up the steps from where, in the starlight of Saturday, you emerged, cigarette smoking and mirror-handed, like a magician's reveal. Glad as I was to see your torso-sized bag of rough, grating hessian, and your pink, white-flower-stitched angora cardigan, I couldn't resist looking up to peg Jupiter. I didn't bother to think I would see either you or it again. And one more time, which is very short, so this is the most crucial distance that I'm getting towards, there's somewhere between erotic and longing here, if those two can go together, which they probably can. And this is a joke that I shouldn't have let myself get away with, so I apologise. This is called Platonic Poem. Strange on my quilt as a victory sign, the ghost of a pair of black tights. Then, quick as a thought, the whole room is gone. I've made my bed, and I'll lie in it.
Now, Cassia. Standing, sitting. Any preference? I'll stand. If I like that. Thank you. This is a very, very exciting, very good here. Especially because quite a lot of my stuff seems to gravitate towards Freud, even though, like Stephen, not a scholar of Freud by any sharp. So this is the poem from the mildly erotic anthology, and basically mine's going to be a set of severe repression. so this is the student. It's 7 a.m. in the park. You're pretending you don't see the grime-chested kendo student drilling. Hakama stretched into a theatre. Bokken now passing like a wing before him. His forearms and fingers are lean and you're feeling his weight on your own and his hands on your wrists. He brings down the sword with a shift of his hips. advances, quite cat-like, fresh sweat on a forelock. Tonight you'll draw Ronin and Heecho like herons. Tonight you'll be dreaming of jostling red fish. It gets more repressed than that. So I was telling Emma that I used to work in a legal library, and for no reason at all, down in the south stacks of the library, there was a book called The Sexual Abnormalities and Perversions, and it was written by someone claiming to be a doctor called Clifford Allen, and it was written in the 50s. I would not go to this doctor. So these are two case studies that he mentioned. It's got a little bit from Clifford Allen at the start, explaining it. So Clifford says, almost at the first moment when the patient started treatment, he showed negative transference and commenced by complaining that his difficulties were much too deep and that I should not be able to do him any good. He said, if you are not adult, you cannot deal with adult problems. Explaining it. The counter girl at the chemist, blonde, pretty as a paper chain, sucks her pigtail as I try to decide. The shelf is a field of plugs designed to quiet screaming infants when the nipple aches too much. As she bags my blue choice and taps in the price, I imagine her bouncing on top of me, joyfully pink, her breasts slapping her ribs, each calling, catch me. The second my cries grow too guttural, echoing into the stairwell, she jams in the teat of the dummy and the money shot is hostage muffled. Back in the closed world, she hands me change, calls me sir, goes back to her hair, is merciful in not acknowledging my third visit in 5 days. And yes, she's my mother, and it's my mother, and the stars are my fucking mother. Come in. Okay, my third and final poem is also based on one of Clifford Allen's case studies. But it was a more positive result. The person actually managed to kind of get over their own anxiety about a childhood incident with an older cousin. This is called Splitting the Ego with Mary. Among my mother's pansies, down the ribbony path, squirreled behind the privet, she slipped down her underwear. Like a cat watching the pointing finger instead of its subject, I examined the polka dots measling the cotton until she hoisted her hem, lay in the grass, and tented her legs. It was a baby mammal, curled and spineless with a paintbrush tuft of hair. It sprang and gave at my stumpy touch, teasing that it would lick me up to the elbow. For months I stared at the swarm of block-colour trains on my walls, ignoring my ant farm and slingshot, charting with those same stumps the differences between us, flew hot, rhythmic. The door, the shriek, later the kitchen knife long as my femur, the threat that cut short my hand's sub-blanket expedition in favour of kit planes, cutlery, scout knots, oh Mary, come back for the summer. The string stings, I spill my food, I stretch in disturbing ways, I tear apart each furry stem, but the mise-en-scene of your pinkness does not distort. Mary, I'm older now. Show me again.
So, as promised, I'm going to tell you a bit about my findings from the mild erotic survey / submissions process for the book. And then each of the poets will be reading some poems by other people. So kind of a little bit emulating that submissions process by kind of showing us what they think is erotic. So I read over 600 poems, mildly erotic poems, erotic poems in the submissions, and 23. And I edited the book with my friend Rachel Piercy. So we discussed all of them. So that's 600, that's a manageable number to actually go through them and read them several times and talk about them. And this is our first time we edited an anthology together as well, so we were very, very thorough. And we found that the challenge of this being our first anthology as well as a mild erotic anthology is that we had to ask ourselves not only do we agree that this is a good poem, but we also had to ask
is this erotic and do we find this erotic? And eventually realised that it was going to be impossible to keep this objective and try and make it an objectively erotic anthology. We were going to have to reveal something of ourselves in our selection, and then for myself in the introduction to the book, which was slightly alarming because I didn't set out to reveal my erotic preferences to the world, but it seemed that this is actually what was going to happen. So with that in mind, allow me to introduce you to my erotic preferences. So what I decided I felt about eroticism, so obviously everyone had very views, but what I decided was that I didn't think just talking about the details of sex was erotic. I thought, that's mechanics and it can be very, very sexy, but it's just the motions alone aren't erotic. But what I found really erotic was the headspace. So there's a lot of erotic charge from hearing people's thoughts, either while having sex or all the way around, so even before and after. That was the thing that created the tension between the reader and me. No, between the writing and me. And that's because it's to do with the desire and the associations around the actions and the personal history. So I felt like I couldn't really divorce the actions from the person, the people who are actually doing it, which was, I found a bit disappointing in myself. I kind of thought that actually I was very, very cool and I could consider sex just as a separate kind of action, but actually I thought, now I am interested in the backstories, basically, of everyone. And I also discovered that I really... the kind of the neatness and the glossiness and the kind of the slickness of some depictions of sex didn't do anything for me either, and I was much more interested in the messy details. So, and the kind of the surprising and the often disturbing aspects were the things that actually crossed over into being erotic. So I think you heard in Ruth's poem Birch, which I still don't entirely understand, but there's that mystery there and the surprising. You don't expect to hear see the word lichen in an erotic poem, but still it just... Yeah, so sometimes there is that mystery around it, and I think the overall conclusion that came to is that everyone else's interpretations of eroticism is just endlessly fascinating. So there's also an erotic charge in just surprise what everyone else finds arousing or erotic, because it's fundamentally about the messiness of humans and that the contact between people. So in discovering, in hearing someone else's feelings about eroticism, you've kind of peeled back some layers and you've connected on a quite surprisingly deep level, and I found that very erotic. So the poets are going to read things that they found erotic in other people's thoughts, and in the background these are some pictures by an artist called Mark Andrew Webber, and he's just illustrated a book I've just published by Jacqueline Safra. And these are interesting because Mark didn't set out to create erotic pictures at all. He wanted to get better at drawing figures. Previously, he'd just done typographical maps. So he did life drawing classes and showed me these pictures, and I was instantly struck by how amazingly erotic they were. There'll be three pictures here, and I think they're erotic because they seem to capture something of kind of interior life of the person without really intruding. So there's kind of this tension where Mark's kind of very carefully carved out the picture in lino and is just trying to portray what he sees. And so he isn't proving, he isn't kind of imposing something else, his own assumptions about their thoughts. And I guess that's what Stephen was saying about that distance. There's quite a lot of distance between the artist and ourselves and the subject, but something about that. Again, you can pick up your own views on that. And similarly, I was looking around their exhibition space and seeing all the little classical figures showing their genitals, and I thought these probably weren't created, or some of them were maybe created to be erotic, some of them just weren't. And it's just interesting how they've been collected in an exhibition about eroticism. It's just fascinating to see what other people find erotic. So with that in mind, I'm going to introduce Stephen again. So briefly, because most of my erotic
I'm going to read one poem. It's a little long. It's not too long, so I hope you'll forgive me for that. But I think it's just one of the best poems ever. I find it really funny, and I find its title really ridiculous. The poem is called Love, and unless you're 14, it's ridiculous to call a poem Love, and I just find that so funny. Just various examples, I guess, of, it attempts at defining love, which is kind of ridiculous anyway. But there's also, as you would expect, a lot of sex in it as well. It's by a poet, American poet called Matthew Dicknan. It's called Love. We fall in love at weddings and auctions, over glasses of wine in Italian restaurants, where plastic grapes hang on the lattice. Our bodies throb in the checkout line, bookstores, the bus stop, and we can't keep our hands off each other, until we can. So we turn to rubber masks and handcuffs, falling in love again. We go to movies and sit in the air-conditioned dark, with strangers who are in love with heroes like Peter Parker, who loves a girl he can't have, because he loves saving the world in red and blue tights, more than he would love to have her ankles wrapped around his waist, or his tongue between her legs. While we watch famous people play famous people who experience pain, the boy who sold us popcorn loves the girl who sold us our tickets and stares at the runs in her stockings every night, even though she is in love with the skinny kid who sells her cigarettes at the 7-Eleven. And if the world had any compassion, it would let the two of them pass a Marlboro light back and forth until their fingers eventually touched, their mouths sucking and blowing. If the world knew how the light bulb loved the socket, then we would all be better off. We could all dive headfirst into the sticky parts. We could make sweat a religion. We could light a candle and praise the holiness of smelliness. Imagine standing beneath the gothic archways of feet, the gilded bowls of armpits. Who doesn't want to kneel down and pray before the altar of the mouth? For my part, I'm going to stop right here, on this dark night, on this country road, where country songs come from, and kiss her, this woman, below the trees, which are below the stars, which are below desire. There's a music to it. I can hear it. Johnny Cash, Biggie Smalls, Johann Sebastian Bach. I don't care what they say. I loved you the way my mouth loves teeth. The way a boy I know would risk it all for a purple dinosaur who, truth be told, loved him. There is no accounting for it. In fact, there are no accountants balancing the books of love, measuring the heart's distance and speed. In the Midwest, for instance, there are fields of corn madly in love with the scarecrow, his potato sack head and straw body standing among the dog-eared stalks, his arms stretched out like a farm Christ full of love. Turning on the radio, I know how much AM loves FM. It's the same way my mother loved Elvis, whose hips all young girls love, sitting around the television in poodle skirts and bobby socks, watching him move across the screen like something even sex dreamed of having. He loved me tender for so many years, but I was born after a long night of Black Russians and canasta while Jailhouse Rock rocked. I love the way my screen door, if it isn't latched shut, will fling itself open to the wind, how the clouds above me look like animals covered in milk. And I'm not the only one. Stamps love envelopes. The licking proves it. Just look at my dog, who obviously loves himself with an intensity no human being could sustain, though you can't say we don't try. The S&M goddess who brings her husband to the mall dressed in a leather jumper, leading him through the food court by a leash. The baker who scores his wife's name into the thin skin of the pumpernickel before peeling it into the oven. Once a baby lizard loved me so completely he moved into my apartment and died of hunger. I was living there with a girl who loved to say the word shuttlecock. She would call me at work and whisper shuttlecock into my ear, which loved it. The blast off of the first word sending the penis into space. Not that I ever imagined my cock being a spaceship, though sometimes men are like astronauts orbiting the hot planets of women, amazed that they have travelled so far, wanting to land, wanting to document the first walk, the first moan, but never truly understanding what has brought them there. Love in an elevator, love in the backseat of your parents' Chevette, love going to college, cutting her hair, reading class and sleeping with other girls. Sometimes love is lying across the bed, but it might not be yours. And sometimes it travels into a hostile territory where it's hardly recognisable, but they're all the same. I know a man who loves tanks so much he wishes he had one to pick up the groceries, drive his wife to work, drop his daughter off at school with her Little Mermaid lunchbox, a note hidden inside, next to the apple, folded with a love that can be translated into any language. I hope you do not suffer.
Have you imagined having sex with me? Planned exactly how it would be? Have you pictured all the faces, the sighs, the eyes, the grimaces? Have you schemed how we'd get started? Am I flash naked, legs parted, or maybe there's some backstory, or brave knights and morning glory, or a plumber, or a pizza boy, and what am I, coquette or coy? Am I Russian, or am I Thai, with skin on thin or fat on thigh? Am I a pliable, edible fool, or cougar clawed, matured and cruel? Do I like you? Do you hope I do? Do you wish I were more open with you? I might be flora or fauna, or eve or dawn, alder trees, laurel leaves, spider, swan. I'm 5'7", fair, Caucasian, territory vulnerable to invasion. I'm all states, I'm armies campaigning, I am trying and taxing and waxing and waning, I'm in orbit, I'm a film on repeat, I'm victory, I'm cold, I'm young, I'm defeat, stretched for miles, and if you tried to run like a stream down a mountainside, more faithful than you meant to be, you could run for hours and never leave me.
Choices for otherworldly poems. I was having a little bit of a hunt around for new erotic material on the internet today. Poems, not to you for this. And I came across, which I'm not going to read because A, it's quite long, and B, it goes beyond erotic. But I recommend looking up Ordered the Platonic Blow. Which is just reads like a penthouse reader's wife's thing, but two men, and it's very, very good. Anyway, this is not that. So the first one is three short poems by the haiku poet Basho, Japanese haiku poet, and they don't have titles as much as his did. So this is three by him. A sturdy oak in the plum orchard, totally indifferent to the blossoms. Not knowing the name of the tree, I stood there in the flood of its sweet smell. Having sucked deep in a sweet peony, a bee creeps out of its hairy recesses. Quite like that. I don't know why I went through that. And to end on, someone with the perfect name for an event like this, E.E. Cummings. This is called May I Feel, said he. May I feel, said he, I'll squeal, said she. Just once, said he. It's fun, said she. May I touch, said he. How much, said she. A lot, said he. Why not, said she. Let's go, said he. Not too far, said she. What's too far, said he. Where you are, said she. May I stay, said he. Which way, said she. Like this, said he. If you kiss, said she. May I move, said he. Is it love, said she. If you're willing, said he. But you're killing, said she. But it's life, said he. But your wife, said she. Now, said he. Ow, said she. Tip top, said he. Don't stop, said she. Oh no, said she. Go slow, said she. Come, said he. Said she. You're divine, said he. You're mine, said she.
And finally, Greece will get us.
one enduring myth that seems to crop up across all different art forms, and that's Leda and the Swan. And it's a tricky one because essentially it's a rape story, but it's also about being overcome by the sublime. So I want to start with two interpretations of that story, one by William Butler Yeats and the other one is by H.D., who was a friend and former analysand of Freud's. I'll start with the Yeats. Oh, and anyone who doesn't know the myth, Zeus, lord of all the gods, in order to avoid the suspicions of his wife Hera, used to pitch up at any of his proposed conquests in costume, effectively. So he would appear, he'd appear as a bull for Europa, a shower of coins for Danae, and various other things, but in this case it's a storm. A sudden blow, the great wings beating still above the staggering girl, her thighs caressed by the dark webs, her nape caught in his bill. He holds her helpless breast upon his breast. How can those terrified, vague fingers push the feathered glory from her loosening thighs? And how can body laid in that white rush but feel the strange heart beating where it lies? A shudder in the loins engenders there the broken wall, the burning roof and tower, and Agamemnon dead, being so caught up, so mastered by the brute blood of the air. Did she put on his knowledge with his power before the indifferent beak could let her drop? And this is the HD who takes a very different approach. Leda. Where the slow river meets the tide, a red swan lifts red wings and a darker beak. And underneath the purple down of his soft breast uncurls his collar. Through the deep purple of the dying heat of sun and mist, the level ray of sunbeam has caressed the lily with dark breast, and flecked with richer gold its golden crest. Where the slow lifting of the tide floats into the river and slowly drifts among the reeds, and lifts the yellow flags, he floats where tide and river meet. Oh, kingly kiss, no more regret, nor old deep memories to mar the bliss. Where the low sedge is thick, the gold daylily outspreads and rests beneath soft fluttering of red swan wings and the warm quivering of the red swan's breast. I was also trying to find something that was more modern, and I second Kirsty's recommendation of the Auden. It's completely outrageous. And very, very long. This is by an Anglo-American poet called Dante Michaud. And it comes from his Amorous Shepherd collection, which is... the whole texture of the collection actually is quite erotic, but this one in particular. Big, pretty. Tall and green, his gigantic youth, knowing no man who can keep him earthbound, who can hold his confusion in one hand and caress him with the other. He lists like a cypress, pressing its passion toward everything, music, flirtation, those white teeth and comely smile, the drunken days of being sought after. Oh, big, pretty, easy now, careful not to buck the lasso of my yearning and bruise your honey. Sweet, sweet prize of victory. Entice the slow silk drizzle of a night deep elation. All these kisses for your almost unending legs. Come lean against this rock, big pretty. Lean into this mountain stroke. Brace yourself. I'm coming. And finally, that's a bit Sappho. She wrote a book on Eros, basically. She's really now that whole longing, that idea of deferred consummation. She was writing in 600 BC, and so, but her work still stands up. And this is probably the most popular fragment, because we only have her work in fragments. And as it's a fragment, it does end rather enigmatically. And this translation is by Anne Carson. Fragment 31. He seems to me equal to gods, that man, whoever he is, who opposite you sits and listens close to your sweet speaking and lovely laughing. Oh, it puts the heart in my chest on wings. For when I look at you, even a moment, no speaking is left in me. No. Tongue breaks, and thin fire is racing under skin, and in eyes no sight, drumming fills ears, and cold sweat holds me, and shaking grips me all. Greener than grass I am, and dead, or almost, I seem to me, but all is to be dead, because even a person of poverty, there it is. What type of erotic poetry you're reading, or what you want from your erotic poetry. I mean, Emma talked a lot about the differences of people's approaches, and I think that if we go back to the Auden poem, which is incredibly explicit and really not up to scratch in terms of the quality of Auden's work, you know, he rhymes things like, I don't know if you can remember any of them, but things like your unending legs with Herculean eggs, and it's all just kind of, it's quite bizarre.
Guess what he was talking about.
So it's quite funny. It's quite funny. And I think humour has a place in erotic work, but, and it's very graphic, and on that very, base level, it's quite arousing. I find most of the arousing erotic poems I read as a heterosexual woman, probably those written by gay men, because they eulogise the male form very effectively, perhaps because they not only respond to it physically, but also inhabit it themselves. So they have that double insight. The Dante Michaud also is writing as a gay man. But then, what Emma was talking about earlier, about the headspace of eroticism, I love to have that there too, so it depends on what I'm looking for, really.
I don't know. It's one of those things where I feel as though when I'm directed toward it, I don't really go along with it. That's the sort of explicit thing that you just mentioned, and when you're saying that things are obviously about sex, that doesn't interest me too much. When there's a general suggestion, you know, by innuendo, the mild version of innuendo, not that innuendo, when it's being suggested toward me, maybe by a total description, you know, where there's no other way to think about this description other than this is written by someone who desires something. When I get to that realization, if I'm helped to that realization, I find that very exciting. But I suppose when it's between people, it becomes erotic in a way. If someone's describing that definitely very handsome wardrobe, I would not, you know, in sort of total descriptive detail, I wouldn't think of it as being erotic. But I think the impulse is the same to describe something so totally that it's present.